Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode, second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is March 16th, 2019, the last Saturday of winter, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400, and somebody did. So whoever the somebody is that did, you're on the air with The Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I was going to ask you a question concerning this wall that they wanted to build. You know, does everything really have to have a price to it? Couldn't that wall be donated by the Iron Steel Workers of the United States of America and put a plaque there that that's what it was done? And if it did happen that way for any reason, how would they affect the economy? You have a good day. Thank you.
All right, and
I can answer that one real quick. The cost of the wall is not so much the steel that goes into the structure. That's relatively insignificant. The cost of the wall is the labor to put it up and the property that has to be purchased for the wall to go on. And this is the big question. And the reason there is a wall, by the way, or barriers, just about everywhere but Texas. And the reason it isn't in Texas is because the Rio Grande wanders around, and the most efficient place to build a wall is north of the Rio Grande in a straight line. And there's a really, really, really big bunch of property that belongs to U.S. citizens that is going to be cut off by the wall. It will be south of the wall. They're not going to put a border crossing point at every place where a person has a big farm or ranch that's in a loop of the Rio Grande. And the big question, and the reason I don't think the wall is going to be built in Texas, is simply that the cost of, if you're going to take somebody's access to their property away from them, you're going to say, you cannot go on your property anymore, and we're the federal government, and we said so. Well, the takings clause in the Constitution says the government has now got to buy that property at its current rate, and some of those places are golf courses, there's people who have houses down there. The cost of purchasing all of that land plus building the wall has been estimated by several reliable sources that I've read at $50 billion. And therein is the problem. I'm sure the steelworkers of the United States wouldn't be willing to take off time and go down there and build the wall because their manufacturers, the people they work for, are not willing to pay them while they're doing it, so that wouldn't work real well.
And this is a common misunderstanding about industry in general. United States Steel, which is the largest steel manufacturer in the United States, made a quarterly profit in December of $600 million,
mm-hmm.
which would pay a very tiny fraction of the cost of the wall. All of their profits for a quarter, they would basically have to donate all of their income. All of them would have to donate all of their income for a good number of years to pay for the wall.
Now, we've come up with a solution. We have a caller, so hang on just a moment, caller. We have come up with an interesting solution. I think the way to pay for the wall is very, very simple. Everybody who wants a wall checks a little box on your income tax return and says, I agree to have my taxes raised 5% or 10% or whatever to pay for the wall. And when we get enough money to build the wall, build the wall.
Yeah, make it truly voluntary. If the people of the United States want to fund the wall, they could choose to do that.
That is right.
And what you'll see is that most people, even people that agree with it, when they see the amount of money that it's going to take, this is when you start using lots of millions, like hundreds of millions and then into billions. For some reason, it's really hard to keep track of how much money that really is. Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
And if you paid, let's say, $5,000 in taxes last year, are you willing to pay an extra $500 every year until enough money accumulates?
And if you are, giving you the opportunity to do that would be a good thing. Congress right now is supposed to say, this is what we're spending the money on, and I don't think anybody listening to us believes that Congress is doing a very good job of that. Now we have this big argument across political divides and into executive and legislative branches and into dinner party conversations and coffee shop conversations over how much money needs to be spent and how much needs to be borrowed, and nobody's saying how do we come up with the revenue to pay for it. That's dangerous. All right, we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Caller?
Hello.
I think we lost him.
Oh, he went away, or she went away.
Yeah, well, the...
You notice how few she's we get calling?
Yeah, it's not always been the case, but it is certainly so this time around. I wanted to address a couple of things
to say the personal savings rate that the caller
that's exactly what I was going to say.
Last hour talked about. Personal savings rate in the United States right now is 7.6%. And when did you say it was... 3.5
before the Great Recession, for 3 years in a row, it was 3.7 and 3.6%. That was dangerous, and we talked about that at the time. We talked about it at length, saying we had to have a higher savings rate if we wanted to avoid catastrophe. Our savings rate in 2018 was significantly up from 2017. So people are socking it away, and they're doing a good job there. I think they could do more. I mean, we in 2012. Had a savings rate in the United States of 12%.
Well, you know, but the backside of that is when the savings rate was at 6% earlier in 2018, month by month, BEA,
right.
Bureau of Economic Analysis tracks this, the economy was booming. And
because people were spending that money.
Right. We had a slowdown right at the end of the year last year that caused the quarter to go negative on and our GDP to drop and a lot of things to happen. Well, that's in December is when our savings rate jumped to 7.6%. So if we save more money, it will slow the economy down. And the Japanese are famous savers. They're wonderful at saving lots of money, and they have a zero GDP growth. So there's a balance in here. And I think at 7.6%, which is our average right now, we're doing very, very well as savers in the United States, certainly far better than we've done in the past. And if, by the way, if you want to see more savings, it's really simple, raise interest rates. But if you raise interest, the Fed raises interest rates a little bit, we could put us into a recession, and then you'll see a lot of savings.
Right.
So this is the balance that the Federal Reserve has to make, is if they raise interest rates, we get more savings, but they also make borrowing more expensive. But people get more interest on their CDs and their savings accounts, and that makes them save more money, but it slows the economy down.
People are buying less because they're saving more.
Right.
So that's the balance, because we need purchases to happen, or people go out of business, and then the savings don't really matter all that much. But we still need people not to overpurchase. So the idea is this savings rate between 6 and 7% is pretty healthy. 7.6% is really good. We like that. It wouldn't mind long-term seeing a 10% saving rate, but that would slow down the economy a bit. So what we tend to see is that the older generations tend to save at a higher rate than the younger generations. And this isn't based on millennials or Xers or baby boomers. It's just as people get older, they recognize they need more savings. That's Thomas Jefferson wrote about that. So did Socrates, that over time we tend to get more conservative with our own finances. That's pretty standard stuff, and I think it's just funny that we keep rediscovering that and going, oh, wow, this new discovery. It's just common sense. That the caller on the savings rate, that's a good sign. This is the conflicting data that we talk about. For many years, we talked about it being way too low, the savings rate. Now we're at a relatively healthy amount. The consumer debt level is coming up, but if you compare consumer debt to savings, it looks better. So we've got a lot of conflicting stuff out there, as you normally do in a cyclical bull, cyclical bear environment. We're not talking about major catastrophic events or major booming events. What we're seeing is relatively healthy profits followed by relatively minor drops in profits, and that's what we would expect in the next recession. So I covered up all of the other stuff that he put at the end there. Is that last caller last hour, we were very impressed with the directions of those questions. But bringing that data all together was important.
One of the things you have to be careful when you're reading economic data is to go read the data. And the commentary is often going to be slanted. For example, there are some alarmists out there who said, because the absolute numbers, the nominal numbers on consumer debt are up, and because the nominal numbers on corporate debt are up, are higher than we've seen before, that we are in for some kind of big crash. And the reason they're saying that is because the last crash we have was debt-related. I mean, so obviously our next crash will be debt-related. Well, that's not necessarily a true statement. What you have to do is go looking for opposing positions if you want to read commentary. Opinion is dangerous, which is why we like our favorite organization in the United States government is the Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Yes.
And that's where we both went.
Yeah.
And as soon as you said something about consumer debt, we went over there and said, oh, 7.6% is our savings rate.
And the personal savings in 2018 was over $1 trillion. And just as a side note, in 2006 and 2007, personal savings in 2006 was $317 billion. 2007 was $295 billion. So you're talking about less than a third of the savings rate today when we have equivalent personal debt.
And we're in an age where there is too much information, and a lot of the information is opinion. And unfortunately, opinion comes with a bias, even our opinion. That's why sometimes we sound like we're contradicting ourselves. Is right now about the future of the economy, I have two distinct opinions, and they're in conflict with each other. One is the consumer spending is holding up, the income levels are continuing to rise, the personal debt levels are not excessive. That would indicate that the economy has got a good run ahead of it and everything seems to be happy. But I turn around and look at industrial production, industrial output, export-import balances, and I look over at the other side of that, auto sales, home sales, and say, whoa, it looks like things are slowing down.
Now, all of this is related to interest rates and foreign trade. And those are both things that have to do with governmental actions right now. We've got a lot of borrowing going on at the government level to pay for debt that we're spending without revenue. We've got a change in governmental practice on how we import and export. So that's going to have a noticeable impact. And that's the conflicting data that we're seeing, is that there's a new spoon in the pot. And that spoon, we have to figure out where it fits, because there's some other spoons in the pot. There's a lot of cooks in this particular kitchen, and I prefer to have fewer cooks.
You know, if we're in a position where we have unrealized, if we've got tax rates too high, and they're not, they're really slowing the economy down, and we've got interest rates too high, and they're really slowing the economy down, a little change can be a great stimulus, but that is at the bottom of the economic cycle.
Right, and that, again, that when we talk about Keynes or about Friedman, two economists that are held, in, at least after their deaths, as being completely counter to each other, when you actually read their stuff, they both talk about it's a good idea to do stimulus spending in a downturn. It is not a good idea to do stimulus spending in an upturn. And they both fully agreed on that. They had differences on whether or not debt should be used. Keynes said in a downturn, debt should be used. In an upturn, you should pay off the debt. Friedman said never use debt. So they agreed on a lot more things than the Republicans or the Democrats would have you believe when they talk about their patron saint of economics, and say this is the reason why we tend to do this. Well, the Republicans have been about borrow and spend while holding up Milton Friedman, who hated debt. And the Democrats have been about stimulus spending and up, in up positions and up economic events, while Keynes very clearly said you should not be stimulus spending at that point. You should be raising your taxes at that point to increase your reserves so you don't have as much debt in the downturn. And that's, you know, you just common sense, if you think about it from that perspective. We've been speaking with less technical terms in this area this episode. The reality is that common sense should prevail here, only common sense is not that common. It's got a misnomer. We should be spending what we take in as revenue while times are good, with a little bit of extra revenue to pay down debt. And when times are bad, it's okay to get some debt. It's not a good idea if you're in a business or if you're in a personal situation where you're making the most money you've ever made in your life to believe that you will always make this much money, and to go into debt to the extreme edge of your income is a bad idea, because if a downturn happens, you're now beyond the extreme edge of your income. That's the point.
There's another major change going on in the world this is a poor segue to change subjects.
I got a little whiplash.
China is on the verge of becoming a net importer.
In fact, it may have actually happened mm-hmm. last year.
So the point is that China has been a net exporter and has been driven by exports and normally has a really high balance of trade with the rest of the world. But what's happening is they've got a growing middle class, they've grown a growing affluent class who wants to buy stuff. And a lot of the stuff they traditionally, they were buying until very recently, was from the United States. And one of the reasons our economy, I suspect, and we won't know until the end of this quarter and then a little beyond that when the Bureau of Economic Analysis comes out and tells us what the GDP growth was for the first quarter of this year, but I suspect you're going to see a low number. And you may see a very low number. You may see it below 1%. But one of the reasons, very frankly, one of the reasons our economy is slowing down, there's a number of reasons there, but one of them but people don't generally expect is because the Chinese economy is slowing down. And we, believe it or not, were exporting a lot of things to China. We were on the verge of becoming their number one oil importer until they basically have cut us off temporarily until the trade war is over. And we and China are very, very, very interdependent. So one of the things we don't look at too much, unless you're an economist or a person who deals in imports, exports, is the fact that the Chinese economy slowing down probably won't be at all good for the United States.
Right.
And that's a hard thing to get your mind around. It's a hard thing to get our mind around that the raising of tariffs last year marked a surge in U.S. imports and a decrease of U.S. exports because we raised tariffs on imports. But yeah. We said that was going to happen. And by the way, we can go to the Commerce Department. It's happening.
Yeah, we've got recordings of our radio program saying this is what happens. And the fact that we have to refer to it is silly because there's textbooks written on the subject, many great meaty books of information saying raise tariffs and you will increase your import-export deficit. You will not do the thing you think you're going to do.
And let me explain again why the Chinese economy slowing down is potentially dangerous to the United States. What we do in the United States is the federal government borrows a tremendous amount of money. And one of our largest, not necessarily our largest, from month to month it'll be different. China and Japan are two of the largest loaners of money to the United States. So we have this negative trade balance with Japan. We send a lot of money to China, for instance, and Japan.
Yeah, and they turn around and loan us that money back for our debt.
Right. They loan the money back so the federal government can run a big deficit and do lots of things without charging us taxes.
Which is how we say we're funding the stimulus to cause our economy to keep booming. So keep that in mind. This is the chain we're following.
The stimulus that keeps the economy booming, by the way, has run our consumption rate, our consumer spending rate, up above the capacity of the United States to produce stuff, so we then buy stuff from overseas. It's a nice little circular pattern. But here's the problem. Let's say the Chinese economy does continue to slow down and goes into recession. And the Chinese no longer have a lot of money to loan to us, and so they stop loaning us money. What would happen in the United States? Well,
cost of borrowing will go up. That's
we're still going to have plenty of people to borrow the money. It's just that they're going to want more. There's going to be fewer people borrowing the money, so the interest rates will go up, which means the interest on the national debt will go up, and the interest on
that will be a bigger
chunk. Mortgages will go up.
Yeah,
and it'll slow the United States economy. So
new mortgages,
it will, you know, the new mortgages. Yes, and the point is, we are interdependent with the Chinese economy, whether we like it or not. And yes, they are doing some things that need to be stopped.
Absolutely.
And yes, they need to behave better, and yes, there's a lot of changes that need to go on, but don't think for a moment that if the Chinese economy craters, we should be clapping our hands because it will cause interest rates in the United States to rise dramatically, and that will be very, very, very unpleasant in the United States.
Right. Now I'm going to do an equally sharp segue. We're going to do whiplash a second time, although it's minorly associated. There's a level of complexity when we talk about interlinking economies that is fairly high, but it is not as high a level of complexity as the U.S. tax code. And I have a relatively lighthearted example to give of how complex the tax code can be and how, in some ways, silly it is. Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, newly royal, is an American citizen. You're aware of this. I don't know.
Yes, I'm aware of
it. She's pregnant.
Yes, I'm aware of that, too.
So it's big news. The child is going to be somewhere in the line of throne succession, seventh or something like that. But also will be automatically a U.S. citizen. So the taxes will have to be filed. Kitty taxes start on unearned income of more than $2,200 a year, even if you don't live in the United States, and quite often you're going to be paying taxes somewhere else. The United States is a very rare country in that it charges taxes on its citizens, even if they haven't lived in the country at all, and at least makes you file your income tax return. You have to file your forms every year, period. If you have an account with your name on it that's worth more than $10,000, you've got to file that with the U.S. Treasury. This is a young royal of the United Kingdom who will have assets of far more than that. The royal family of the United Kingdom has hired a very large U.S. accounting firm just to keep up with the paperwork of the tax filing of someone who may never live in the United States, but is a U.S. citizen. So the idea that if you have any degree of assets and you have a child and you're living somewhere else, that the United States would charge you taxes on it when even this is an oddity that most people don't know about. If you decide to renounce your U.S. citizen, that is certainly not a good idea, just as a side note. But if you do, there's an exit penalty tax. You've got to pay a tax for not wanting to pay the other taxes. So why? And the question about why is it the tax rates are set the way they are? Why is it that the tax brackets start at the level of income that they do? Well, the first thing to say is that the question why in this particular instance is silly. It's because. That's the answer. Because there is no why. The tax code may have at times had someone saying this is the reason why we're implementing this particular nuance to the tax code. But in all of the changes that take place in the years after that, that nuance, the why of it, is completely destroyed. There's no reason for it anymore. It is because it is, and it interacts because Congress says it does. And what I would, this is me talking about my druthers, what I'd rather have happen, wouldn't it be nice if the promise that was given in the campaign for presidency this last time was the simplification of the tax code.
Well, there's another one.
What's that?
I was just listening to an excerpt from one of President Trump's speeches the other day. He promised to reduce the national debt and pay it off in 4 years.
Right. And so we've got these two things that caused us to have a great deal of hope in this presidency, to simplify the tax code and reduce the debt. We've gotten the reverse. Though those of you that have filed your taxes this year, if you do not own a business and you don't have a relatively complicated situation at all in your income, it seems simple. What you'll notice in the next few years is that the CPA that you've used throughout the last couple of decades is likely to say, hey, you don't need my services anymore. You should use this simple tax software. Well, why would they be turning you away? Because they've got to spend a lot more time on the small businesses. Because it did not get simple. it got a lot more complex. Each dollar is taxed at a different rate, even if it comes from the same source, depending on how you take it out, whether you're an LLC, a sole proprietorship, if you make more than a certain amount of money. The complexity has gotten deranged. This tax software is having a lot of trouble keeping up with it, and we've got really, really good programmers. When the good programmers and the good CPAs are looking at the tax code and saying, well, we got a problem there. And the only reason why we've been able to make it as far as we have with the complexity of the tax code that we have is because of computer technology. This is an unintended consequence of the information revolution, is that we have an absolutely absurd tax code. It is so convoluted and strange. There are tax brackets for tax brackets. If you are making your income off of the sale of a cow, it's a different type of tax than if you're selling gold, and there are 12 tax brackets for gold sales. So when people talk about the overall tax brackets and about lowering taxes, that's all fine. But the amount of money being spent on maintaining that you are paying the right amount of taxes, if we look at that and we say, if the corporations and the small businesses of the United States were to take all of the money that they're paying on the preparation for their taxes and pay that as a tax instead, we would have this huge inflow of revenue. So the simple act of simplifying the code would cause revenue to go up. It is, just try to imagine being an IRS auditor. You don't know the code either.
The last time we simplified the code was in 1986.
Right.
And it was a pretty simple code, and we have managed to complexify it. This last law, by the way, this one that this taxpayers...
Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
The Tax Cut and Jobs Act that passed in 2017, went into effect in 2018, was referred to by a CPA I met recently as the CPA Full Employment Act of 2017.
Yes.
Because he said the complexity that went into that, particularly for businesses, is right off the scale. And by the way, here we are approaching the time when taxes are technically due unless you file an extension.
Less than 1 month at this
point.
And
the IRS still hasn't published. This is a year and a quarter roughly after the law was passed, and the IRS is still publishing clarifications and hasn't published all the rules for it yet. And so we're just kind of shooting in the dark out there. And by the way, the Secretary of the Treasury said that they were going to waive penalties for failure to follow the tax code because nobody understood what it meant yet. Nobody understood the new tax law yet.
And the fact is that Congress doesn't understand the new tax code. I mean, when we talk about the numbers and why is this percentage what's being charged, and we make this assumption that there's some kind of magical software that Congress has access to that will tell them the effect if they tweak this rate, this is the thing that will happen. And that is not the case. They have a clunky Excel spreadsheet. Seriously.
Well, now,
this is how they're making their decisions.
The Office of Management and Budget, by the way, there's a couple of laws that require them to do this, but they ignore it in Congress. The Office of Management and Budget could sit down and give them a few weeks with a change to the tax code, and they'll tell you, here's what we estimate the effect will be.
But Congress doesn't wait for that.
Right. They, in this particular tax law, they cobbled it together and voted to pass it quickly so they could go home
and say they passed a tax cut.
And then later they suddenly realized that some of the things they put in there didn't make any sense at all. It is unfortunate that we pass political tax laws like that. All I got to say is that we're going to – this, and by the way, unlike other tax laws that have been passed that I've looked at and said, well, that's goofy or not goofy, this one's got to be fixed. And it's got to be fixed or we will wind up with a debt, a huge debt. And I know it's not palatable to most people, and it's certainly not comfortable for me to say I need to pay more taxes. But we need to have a higher income tax rate.
The revenue needs to come up.
Right. The point is, in
if we're going to spend like this
for the calendar year 2018, the federal government's revenue dropped by 1.5%, despite the fact we're in a booming economy with full employment. With everybody running at full speed, the government's revenue, which was already a negative number,
dropped even further.
And that is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a good thing. When the economy slows down, and I say when, because we are going to get a recession at some point.
We have not suddenly become immune out of nowhere with no action on our part. Suddenly we are not immune to recessions. They happen. They will happen again.
Here's the thing that... The caller last hour was concerned about debt. Here's the thing that concerns me at this point. We're running what is projected to turn into $1 trillion a year deficit. It may turn into $1 trillion a year deficit this year. With the economy running at full tilt. When the economy slows down in the next recession, and I can't tell you when that's going to be. The general economists say sometime between 2020 and 2022, if you add up all the percentages, it amounts to nearly 100% probability we'll have a recession in there. But when we have the next recession and the economy slows down and the unemployment spending goes up and all the other spendings that go up to cushion the bottom of a downturn, the deficit growth will go off the scale, and at that point, Congress will feel a powerful need when they see the deficits spiraling out of into space and interest rates going up as a result. They will feel an urge to raise taxes just as the economy is slowing down, because we've got to find some way to pay for it. When people start screaming, this deficit is unsustainable, will be the point at which we really should not raise taxes. I know that sounds really crazy.
Right.
But when the economy is slowing down, taking more money out of the economy to pay off debt.
That's where you tip yourself completely over into the recession and make it worse rather than better.
And the concern is that at some point down the road, Congress, either through the existing congresspersons being unelected and new people coming in, or through suddenly the public pressure when the headlines start saying this debt is unsustainable, we're spending way too much on interest, suddenly sees us at the bottom of a downturn and raises taxes.
This is what the Europeans did in the Great Recession. That's what austerity was. We've got to pay off all this debt. It's too expensive, so we're going to raise taxes and prolong the recession into a much longer recession. Well, the United States, by doing stimulus spending both at the George W. Bush level and then by Barack Obama, and by stimulating the economy, by the Federal Reserve
making it easy,
that allowed at the bottom of a recession us to recover very quickly. We're trying to do that now at the top because it worked so well at the bottom. But this is not a good idea to do it that way.
And for whatever it's worth, we're repeating history. In the midst of a boom 100 years ago.
1907?
Well, this is post-1907. 1907, as we approach the 1920s, Congress, of course, it was a world, if we pull out the effect of World War I in there, what happened is, Congress, and for that matter, the Federal Reserve at that point, tried to stimulate the economy. This happened in the 1920s. At the peak, when everything was booming, they gave it, quote, this was the quote, a little shot of whiskey.
Yeah.
To give it a little more stimulus to keep the boom going a little longer so they could get through elections. And what happened was, when it finally came time, we realized everything was spiraling out of control. What did Congress do? They turned around and raised taxes, raised tariffs.
Smoot-Hawley Act.
And in the process, plunged us into the Great Depression. Now, frankly, this is something that goes on over a many-year period. We're talking about a decade of events collapsed into one statement here, and we don't tend to think that long.
We're following that pathway so clearly. We're just walking right down on the same stepping stones. We made a good decision in the collapse that was 2007 and 8, in that the banks, Federal Reserve Bank, stepped in and saved. It was J.P. Morgan, the person, not the company, that did it in 1907. They came in and rescued the banks that were insolvent from making bad loans, and we had a bunch of laws that were passed to make it safer. And then we just followed on this path. Got to be careful that we don't repeat ourselves. We've got another great industrial revolution, automation and AI. And
we got to play commercials.
We do have to play some commercials. Let me, before we go, I want a real quick 2 minutes. There's a bill that's just been introduced into Congress about taking academic research and making sure that none of the academies, none of the universities are using Huawei routers and hubs or Kaspersky antivirus, because the government has finally realized that. By the way, just as a side note, we were talking about this more than a decade ago, that Kaspersky should not be on your computer, that it is run from a facility that is partially paid for by the intelligence service of Russia. And while they deny it left and right, all you have to do is look at the price that they're charging for their software when Chinese and other antivirus software is more expensive. It's because they're getting subsidized by the Russian government. Many of the programmers at Kaspersky are Russian National Guard, and they are in the intelligence service for Russia. Just think about that for a second. If you have Kaspersky on your computer, take it off. Well, this proposal is to put this mandate on the universities to not use Huawei and not use Kaspersky, which is going to make it hard at the university level to figure out what's going on. Why do we allow products in the United States that we know are being used against the citizens of the United States for the benefit of another country? I think that's where we should have made this decision. If you're going to ban a university from doing it, you should just say it shouldn't be on the market so that you can use it. That's a little bit authoritarianism, though. That's a problem. So we got to look at what is safe and what isn't safe. If they're selling us stuff that is just taking our information straight to China or Russia, we shouldn't allow it. And we got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. You want to give the phone number?
If you'd like to give us a call, 254-773-1400.
And we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is March 16th, 2019, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. I wanted to give a warning that I touched on last week that I think it relates to what Jake was just talking about. The SEC last week charged a Dallas-Fort Worth radio show host. Now, not that all radio show hosts are dangerous. His name was Neil Doc Gallagher, and it was called The Money Doctor. And the show's been running since 2014. And so apparently has his Ponzi scheme. And
he's alleged Ponzi scheme.
He's
not been convicted.
I said apparently.
Apparently.
Which is equivalent to alleged.
Well, apparently, so his, well, we haven't said that it's an alleged Ponzi scheme, even if it's apparently a Ponzi scheme.
Well, he's been charged with running a Ponzi scheme, which they didn't say in the charge was alleged. But the SEC seems to believe, as well as the Tarrant County, Dallas County Sheriff's Office, the police departments, they've all taken turns charging him with basically fraud and theft. And he ran this thing from 2014, whatever it was, this alleged thing, to 2019. He took in about $20 million in the last month, in January. Alone, in January of this year, he took in $500,000. What he was doing, of course, was taking the new money that comes in and using it to pay the 5 to 8% guaranteed rates to the early investors. And they're all going to lose money, including the people who feel really good because they got their 5 to 8% of the people who bailed out of it at some point and got their money back. Because the bankruptcy trustee is going to go in, there'll be a federal bankruptcy trustee if this is a Ponzi scheme, and it looks very much like it is. It's going to come back and claw back that money. So let's just say you invested $100,000 with this guy. By the way, he was targeting older, Christian, retired, well-off people, and he was focusing on Christian
Well, I'm at his cached webpage, and the webpage has been taken down. But his mission statement, this is something, when someone's mission statement is overly targeted at a very specific audience, you need to be careful. And that's not always a bad thing, but it means that, particularly when the audience is one that develops trust quickly with similar beliefs. So here's the mission statement. Our mission is to be a vehicle of God's peace and comfort to as many people as possible, helping first with their financial peace of mind, then also with their spiritual, emotional, and family well-being. That sounds fantastic, but there's no meat in there. What is just said is that we're going to provide peace and comfort with helping with finances. That's not a mission statement. That's a statement of belief, which is very different. A mission statement should say how you're going to do it.
This is critical. He was promising a guaranteed safe rate of return of 5 to 8%. Let me tell you something. There are other schemes of legal and illegal kind going on right now that are just as dangerous, and you can be enticed into one very easily. And you'll probably, if the history of Ponzi schemes is a guide, and I think it is, the way people get enticed into these things, just as they did with Madoff and Stanford and the others that have occurred, is people who have been there for years getting this nice stream of income and seeing their account values go up and have these wonderful things to say about this amazing investor that they found.
And all of the statements about the value in their account comes only from the person mm-hmm. who's given them the promises. You need a third-party audit of some kind to make this be verifiable.
So I'm going to say that there's a crucial issue. You can't – nobody can guarantee a rate of return higher than you'll find at a bank CD or a short-term treasury. Nobody can guarantee you're going to get that rate of return. And by the way, I see daily advertisements for 8% annuities. 8% return.
That's not sustainable.
And
that's just not.
I'm literally seeing these every day, and it's not possible. It's just simply not something anybody can do. There's something either misleading. If it was a securities offering, the SEC would hammer them already. But in fact, since it's an insurance offering, they have a lot looser standards for their advertisement.
This is what I see commonly, and I'm just going to give a real quick kind of generic example. The people that tend to be interested in this type of annuity, those high-paying annuities, tend to be older. They're not wanting to see the value of their portfolio drop, or they want some kind of a guarantee on it. So they're told that they can withdraw 6 or 8% from their annuity forever, that it will never stop paying them. It's a guaranteed withdrawal benefit. So they start taking it out, and what the guaranteed withdrawal benefit in many cases does not do is give any kind of a protection on the principal. So the principal is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and if you think of the typical customer here is going to be someone in their late 70s or early 80s who see this guarantee, and so they take the money out, and they're taking out at a faster rate than if somebody had their own market portfolio with mutual funds and sort of thing. Their advisor should be saying, hey, that's too high a rate. You're depleting your principal. You're leaving less to your heirs. These annuities commonly do not pay a large amount to the heirs. They pay the amount of principal that's left over. So the guarantee's never been used.
In many cases, they don't pay the principal that's left over. They don't pay anything.
Yeah, and if you have annuitized, then you have some very, very specific guidelines you have to follow to say whether your heirs get anything at all.
And so there's anybody that says guaranteed risk-free high return, that's, by definition, is misleading you or lying to you. Now, they could be believing with all their heart.
They may be misled and, right. and lied to.
Including the insurance salesman who says guaranteed high yield return.
But or the folks over at that Gallagher firm, Money Doctor. He had some high quality employees that were ethically minded and probably had no idea of what was being perpetrated against their customers, their clients.
The employees that Madoff had. had no idea he was running a scam.
Yeah, they got their salary every month, and they thought, this is great, and I'm working for a good man, and I look at all the happy clients that come
right.
in here.
The same thing was true at Stanford. A lot of us have forgotten about that down in Houston. Texas seems to have more than its fair share of these scams that come up. But the problem with a Ponzi scheme is that it is spread primarily by the people who are victims, and they don't know they're victims. And this is what happens, by the way. Let's say you got in 2014, and you've been getting this high rate of return, and you bailed out before the SEC hammered this guy. Well, then at some point in the not very far distant future, you're going to get contacted and said you owe the bankruptcy trustee everything you got from Doc Gallagher, including your own principal that you took out. You owe it back to and they'll take 100% of it back. Then they'll divide up how much people put in, and you might get 10 cents on the dollar back from there at some point. Although in this particular case, if the SEC is correct, you're not going to get anything back, because he basically spent it all.
Yeah.
And then this is a very common thing. Anytime that you're targeted by group, anytime that somebody offers you a guaranteed high interest rate, you should be scared. And let me throw one more in.
It's true in multi-level marketing as well. Go ahead.
Let me throw one more in. Jake said this, and it's really important, and we'll close out the show on this one. Whoever is advising you should not have access to your money. Let me say that again. Whoever is advising you and managing your money should not have access to that money. For instance, and I'll use our example, we use custodians that are registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission who are audited. We can't get in there and withdraw your money and put it in our pockets. We just can't do it. We don't have custody. If you have an advisor who has access to the money, so your advisor and the people who hold the money are the same thing, you are at some significant risk, and you just need to be aware of that.
Yeah, and you need to look at the audits. You need to make sure that it's being audited. That's the thing, is that if it's being audited, check. If it is being audited, then look at the audits.
And the audit should be from an outside third party.
Yes, and it should
and
be somebody.
And they should send it to you separately.
Yeah, yeah, and that's something that's kind of across the board in the big custodian firms. But when you're talking to a local person who's giving, oh, this is a big one, if you're getting promissory notes from your advisor, that is one of the biggest red flags that exists in the world. Do not take that lightly. Do your research.
Well, that is illegal.
It
simply
depends on who the advisor is. If they purport to do other investments, then it's illegal. But if it's just your CPA, it's not illegal. If it's your insurance agent, it's not illegal. It's just illegal if they don't pay you back. It's important to do your research and know that there's a lot of risk out there. These are the common scams that we see, and we're seeing more of them. Scams pop up more often in the boom times, and we've just had a little bit of a drop, because that's when the boom times when the scammers get caught, is when people have to make a withdrawal above what they would normally do, and they can't get any money out. So now we're about out of time.
We are indeed.
Do you have any final notes?
Well, be careful out there. The economy is balanced and could go up, could go down. A lot depends on the trade results that may come this month.
There's now more millionaires in the United States than there are people in Sweden.
Oh, I'm going to have to think about that one for a while.
If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized investment advice, fiduciary level, to people of high net worth. The local phone number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and contact us through there, read our newsletter, listen to past radio performances. Our emails are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.